This meeting is being recorded.
So, welcome all to the January 2022 meeting of the Ottawa PC User Group. We don't have any announcements, I believe, other than the annual general meeting will be next month. So it will kick off the February meeting with that and then go into the regular program. We do not have Q&A tonight because we no longer have Q&A on regular meeting nights. They will continue on other Wednesday evenings at 7:30 p.m. So the next one will be next Wednesday evening, 7:30 p.m. Hope to see a lot of people out there for that. We are recording, and the audio recording, the deck from Stefan, and the contents of the chat window will go up on our website later on this evening or over the next couple of days. As Bridget will be taking care of that. And with that, I would like to kick it over to Stefan, who has worked for many, many years, retired now, worked for many, many years for the Armed Forces as well as the public service. And he's going to talk to us tonight about cryptography. And take it away, Stefan.
Okay, I will share my screen. So can you see my screen?
Yes, indeed.
Okay. So tonight, this is what I will cover. First, I will briefly describe the sources and the references I used to put the deck together. After that, I will cover some definitions. After that, we'll look at some of the basic cryptology mathematics. The next one, I will give some example of cryptographic algorithms. And after that, we'll look at the application of cryptology. And we'll look at the quantum computing and its impact on cryptography. So the sources I've used, the first one is a book by Bruce Schreiner, Applied Cryptography. It's a very interesting book, it's about 3-inch thick. It covers a lot of stuff, all the protocol, and he even has a bunch of cryptographic program like the source code in the book. So it's very good. If you want to learn more about that, that's a good book to read. Wikipedia for most of the generic stuff. There is one article that I use that compare the symmetric and asymmetric encryption. And I will cover that in the deck, and the quantum computing and its impact on cryptography. So let's look at some definition. So first, what is security? So if you take a letter and lock it in a safe, and you hide the safe somewhere, this is not really security, it's obscurity. You have no idea how secure your safe is. If you take the safe along with its design specification and 100 unethical safes and with their combination, so the world's best safe cracker can study the locking mechanism and they can still not open the safe and read the letter, now you're talking security. These same principle about the safe and the combination can be applied to cryptography. So instead of talking about a safe, we're going to talk about cryptographic algorithms. And instead of talking about a combination, it's going to be the key. Now, if we look at some basic definition, the first one is plain text, basically the message or the file, the image, whatever you're trying to encrypt. Encryption is the process of disguising a message in such a way to hide its substance. The ciphertext is the result of the encrypted, it's the result of the encryption, it's basically the encrypted message or file or whatever you're trying to encrypt. Decryption is the reverse. It's basically the process of turning the ciphertext back into plain text. Cryptography is the art and science of keeping message secure. Cryptanalysis is the art and science of breaking ciphertext, that is, seeing through the disguise. And cryptology is the branch of mathematics encompassing both cryptography and cryptanalysis. So why do we need cryptography? The first thing is confidentiality. So the state of keeping or being kept secret or private. When something is encrypted, if it's encrypted correctly with a good algorithm, and you don't share the key, you will have great confidentiality. Authentication, it should be possible for the receiver of a message to ascertain its origin. An intruder should not be able to masquerade as someone else. And we can easily do that using a cryptographic protocol. Integrity, it should be possible for the receiver of a message to verify that it has not been modified in transit. An intruder should not be able to substitute a false message for a legitimate one. For example, if you ask to make a withdrawal for $100, it should not be possible for somebody to change it to $1,000. So you want to make sure that the integrity of the message remains when it's being sent. And non-repudiation is basically a sender should not be able to falsely deny later that he sent a message. And we'll see how we can do all of these things using cryptography. I will start by the overall process, and sometimes there's some change, but that's a process that is used fairly often.
Stefan, if I can interrupt for just a second, we seem to have an update problem on your screens because I'm still seeing just the second bullet point authentication. I'm not seeing anything beyond that.
Is it catching up now?
Not at this point. Can you move your mouse around? I could just see if we're getting...
Yeah, I'm moving my mouse.
Okay, I'm getting no screen updates coming through at all at this point. Your voice is fine, but the screen is not updating.
Okay, so I will stop sharing.
The mouse just moved.
Okay.
Try changing the slides and change back. Okay, maybe if you stop sharing and reshare.
Yeah, we'll try that. Okay, do you see the authentication bullet?
Still saying just Stefan has started screen sharing. Okay, I'm not seeing anything. I've got your deck here, so if you want, I can do the screen share from here and you talk to the slides.
Yeah.
Okay, let me do that then. So let me take over.
I'll stop sharing.
Okay, let me share screen. And okay. Okay, so there's the slides we've had up to now, and I'm seeing them okay on my laptop. So now we're on the slide, why cryptography?
Okay.
Oh, yeah, we have already gone through that. So non-repudiation process. Okay.
Okay, we'll click once. Okay, so we start with the plain text, and I just put hello. So click enter. Next. It's going to go through the encryption and using the encryption key. And the result of that will be the ciphertext. And as you can see, you can no longer know what the message was originally, the hello message, basically. After that, it goes into when it's being received by the receiver. It goes into the decryption process using the decryption key. Most of the time, these two keys are the same, and you get back your plain text, the hello. Next. So encryption and decryption are done via cryptographic algorithm or cipher. You will see them used interchangeably. The encryption and decryption key or the crypto variable, they will basically control all the encryption is being done. This is how you can change it. It's equivalent to changing the combination on a safe. Next. You control the operation and behavior of the cryptographic, and it can be either private or secret or public, and we'll see that later on. So there are basically two type of key-based algorithms. The first one is called symmetric algorithm, also called conventional algorithm. Next one, asymmetric algorithm, and they also these ones are called public key algorithms. Next. So we'll start with symmetric algorithm, the first, next. So in most symmetric algorithms, the encryption key and the decryption key are the same, or the encryption key can be calculated from the decryption key and vice versa. It requires that the sender and the receiver agree on an algorithm and a key before they can communicate securely. The security of a symmetric algorithm rests in the key. Remember what I said when I used the example of a safe? It's basically the safe, it's built correctly. It's when you have the combination, you can open it. If you don't have the combination, you should not be able to open it. That's the same principle for the symmetric algorithm. But you need to be careful how you manage this key, because if you divulge that key, anyone could encrypt or decrypt your message, basically. As long as the communication needs to remain secret, the key must also remain secret. So if you change the key once per month, after many years, you will have many encryption keys that you need to keep around. And there are two categories. So stream algorithm or stream cipher, they basically operate on the plain text on a single bit or sometimes byte at a time. The next type is block algorithm, and this is the most I have yet to see a stream cipher. Most of the time they are a block algorithm or block cipher, and they operate on the plain text in group of bits, and the group of bits are called blocks. Now, if you want to do communication using symmetric cryptography, the protocol is for the two parties to communicate securely. So what do you need to do? First, the sender and receiver need to agree on a cryptographic algorithm. The sender and the receiver need to agree on a key. The sender take the plain text message, encrypt it using the encryption algorithm and the associated key, and this creates a cipher text message. The sender send the cipher text message to the receiver. The receiver decrypt the cipher text message with the same algorithm and the key to read it. Now, if there is some bad guys that are sitting between the sender and the receiver, have access to the cipher text, they must try to cryptanalyze the cipher text. In other words, they need to find a way to decrypt the message without having the decryption key. There are algorithms that are resistant, as far as we know, to whatever computing power the bad guys could realistically bring to bear on the problem. And more on that later. Next slide. First bullet. So, but the bad guys are not stupid, okay? They will want to listen on the first two steps. So they will know which algorithm and the key, just always at the receiver. So you need to make sure that you protect that. Next bullet. So a good crypto system is one, all the security is inherent in the knowledge of the key and none is inherent in knowledge of the algorithm. This is why key management is so important in cryptography. With a symmetric algorithm, sender and receiver can select the algorithm in public. So, but when you're ready to use it, the key must be done in secret. Next, first bullet. So in summary, symmetric cryptographic have the following problems. First bullet. So the key must be distributed in secret. They are as valuable as a message they encrypt, since knowledge of the key give knowledge of all the message. For encryption system that span the world, this can be a daunting task. often couriers, and carry the keys to their destination. If a key is compromised, and compromise is the word that we use to say the key was stolen, guests extorted, bribed, you beat up to get the keys. And most of the time, this is how they can break an algorithm system unless there is a flaw in the algorithm. Then the bad guys can decrypt all MSA traffic encrypted with that key. They can also pretend to be one of the parties and produce false message to fool the other party. Assuming a separate key is used for each pair of user on a network, the total number of keys increase rapidly as the number of user increase. A network with n user will require n times n minus 1 divided by 2 keys. So you have 10 users, and they want to communicate among each other, but with their own unique key, you will need 45 keys to talk to all the people that are on that group of 10 people. Now we're going to look at asymmetric algorithms. These ones are quite different. So the key used for encryption is different from the key used for decryption. So basically the key has two elements and they are generated at the same time. The first is a public key, which is made public. And how do we do that? Normally we do that via a public key infrastructure, PKI. You may already have heard about that acronym, PKI, so now you understand tonight what does it do. And a private key, which is not made public. You need to keep it only for yourself. The private key cannot, at least in any reasonable amount of time, be calculated from the public key. PKI is a system for the creation, storage, and distribution of digital certificate. And you will see that, for example, when using a web page or sometimes Windows, you will get an error message that says, oh, the certificate is out of date. So it means basically, because when they create these keys, they are valid for a certain period of time and they need to be updated after that. So the way they do that is by using digital certificate, which is basically a file that gives all the information that is required to do the encryption. And a complete stranger can use the public key to encrypt a message, but only a specific person, basically the one with the private key, can decrypt that message. So if we do the same process that we've done for the symmetric, so we start with the sender. So that person has a private key and a public key. And we have the receiver that also has a private key and a public key. So we start with our plain text. And when it's time to do the encryption, to use the key to use for that, we're going to use the public key from the receiver. This will generate the ciphertext, which we can, now it's encrypted, we can send it. And when it's time to decrypt, the receiver will use its private key to decrypt the message, and you're going to get back the plain text. Next, so this is just basically what I just spoke about. It's the same step, basically. Next slide. So the public key cryptographic solve the key management problem with the symmetric crypto system. If the bad guys are listening in the on the entire exchange at the receiver public key, yes, it's available on the PKI infrastructure, and a message encrypted in that key, but they cannot recover either the receiver private key or the message. So we're going to compare now both type of encryption, and there is a difference. First, the symmetric key versus asymmetric key. So in the case of a symmetric key, there's only one key that is used, and it's used both for to encrypt and decrypt the message. In the case of an asymmetric key system, there are two keys, and one is public, one is private. The next one, the complexity and speed of execution. The symmetric algorithms are very simple, and because of that, they can encrypt very fast, large amount of data. Asymmetric, it's more complicated And because of that, it's going to be very slow. So you don't want to encrypt very large file or a lot of information using an asymmetric system. Key length. The key length used for a symmetric system, normally it's 128 bits or 256 bits. And it's based on your security requirement, how long you want that key to be. If you use something smaller than 128, you're going to see in a couple of slides the kind of problems you can get. In the case of the asymmetric system, the key length must be much, much bigger, like in the range of 2048 bits. And if you want to be really secure, probably double that to 4096 bits. In terms of usage, like I said, the symmetric encryption is normally used to encrypt large chunk of data. And the asymmetric is used for smaller amount of data. In terms of security, the secret key is shared. Consequently, the risk of compromise is higher because that key can be in two locations. And if you have access to one of these locations, you can get access to the key, so you can decrypt everything. The private key is not shared. You keep it under your own control. And the overall process is more secure as compared to the symmetric encryption. And finally, example of algorithm. So DES, AES, and I will talk a couple of slides on DES to give you an idea on how these algorithms basically works. An example of algorithm was RSA. So you probably hear that in movies and TV shows, we're going to do a brute force attack. So what is that? So an algorithm is unconditionally secure if no matter how much ciphertext or the crypt analysis has, there is not enough information to recover the plain text. So there's only one that is meet that definition, is a one-time pad. And it's unbreakable even though you have infinite resources. It doesn't matter how many computers you have, you will not be able to recover the original message. I'll know for sure that you have recovered the correct message. And I will cover that later in the presentation. Brute force attack. Basically what you're doing is you can try to break the crypto system by basically trying all the keys one by one and checking whatever when you are using a given key, the plain text that you recover is meaningful. And obviously to do a brute force attack, you will need to know which algorithm is being used and whatever key format they are using. After that, you just generate all of these keys and try them one by one. So there is 50% chance of finding the key after half of the attempt. So let's talk about the key length in bits and what this translates into the number of keys. So if you're using 40 bits as the key or the length of your key, you're going to have a thousand billion keys available. If you're using 56, you can see as you're increasing the key length in bit, the number of keys that the key space gets really, really big. In fact, the formula is 2 to the power of the key length in bits. So earlier I said that most new systems are using 128, so this is the number of keys that are possible, so that's a lot of keys. Also, if you double the key length, like for example, if you have a system that is using 40 bits and decide to go to 80 bits, it will not double the number of keys, it's going to square it. So for example, if you have a 40 bits, you have about a 1 trillion keys. If you were doubling the number of keys, the number of bits to go to 80, like if you're doubling the number of keys, that it would have been a two-year but look at the number. It's much, much bigger. In fact, if you use your Windows calculator and you put that number in and you square it, you will get that number, the very long number. So this table comes from Bruce Schreiner's book. So this is the average time. And as we saw, you need to try about 50% of the keys. But this was the average time for hardware brute force attack in 1995. And these are the abbreviation I will use to say how much money, basically how much hardware you need to buy. So the first column is the original column that was in the table in the Schreiner book that you did in 1995. So it starts with thousands of dollars all the way down to trillions of dollars. I try to estimate the best I can in 2020 what that amount of money, taking in consideration that computer each 18 months, they basically double their, almost double their performance. So with the same amount of money, you can buy more powerful computers. And after that, the next set of information is the key link in bits, if you have 40, 56, 64, 80, 112, and 128 bits. How long will it take to basically break an algorithm? If you're lucky, because if you're lucky, maybe the first key you're going to try is going to be the right key. But if you're not lucky, you will have to try all of them if it's the last one. On average, it's going to be 50%, but you need to do that a whole lot of times. So, for example, if you're using a key length of 40 bits and you have $3,000, which is probably the cost of a fairly powerful desktop today, you can break that in 2 seconds. If basically trying all the various combinations that afford the a key that has 40 bits, trying all of these keys. If you have a key length of 56, it will take on average 35 hours. If you have a key length of 64, it would be a year. So a big jump between 56 to 64 on average a year. If you go to 80 bits, 70,000 years. And if you go to 112, it's 10 to the power of 14. So one with 14 zero years. And if you go to 128, it's going to be 10 to the power of 19. So one with 19 zero years. And our sun will go nova in 10 to the power of 9. So most likely you won't be able to do one if you're using a 128 bit, just because there's too many keys to try. Even though if you are Mr. Amazon, whatever the name of the guy Amazon, you take all of your money to buy all the computers on the planet, it's still 10 to the power of 11. The sun will have gone nova before you are able to try all of the keys and get us break that algorithm, basically. Next slide. We're going to look at some algorithms. So there are many cryptographic algorithms. These are the most common. So data encryption standard, DES, was the most popular computer encryption algorithm. DES is a U.S. and international standard. It is a symmetric algorithm. The same key is used for encryption and decryption. AES is the new, is the replacement for DES. Next. The RSA, and this is the acronym, is the basically name of his creator, Rivets, Shamir, and Alderman, is the most popular public key algorithm. It can be used for both encryption and digital signature. DSA, Digital Signature Algorithm, is used as part of the Digital Signature Standard. It's another public key algorithm. It cannot be used for encryption. It can only be used for digital signature. So we're going to look at some of the basic cryptographic, cryptology mathematics. This will be useful when we look at how algorithm works, basically. So the first one is modulo, also known as mod. So in computing, the modulo operation is the returns a remainder of a division. also called the modulus of an operation. Given two positive number, A and N, A modulo N, abbreviated A mod N, is the remainder of the division of A by N. So a couple of examples, if you have a 5 mod 2, the modulo will be 1, because 5 divided by 2 is 2, and it will be a remainder of 1. If you do 9 mod 3, it will evaluate to 0, because 9 divided by 3 has a quotient of 3 and a remainder of 0. And the mod operation always return a number that is between 0 to n minus 1. Exclusive OR. So before we talk about the exclusive OR, we'll talk about the OR and the truth table. And 0 is false and 1 is true. And a truth table is basically you list all the possible input. Here I have two input, input A, input B, and this is all the various values. So if I have two inputs, there is 4 possibilities, and A or B means that at least one of the input is true. So the first row, they are both false, so give a 0 for false. But as soon as one of the input is 1, the output is 1. And the OR has a number of properties. If you do A or 0, you get A. If you do A or A, so with the same input, you get A. And if you do A or B and you do or B again, you only get A or B. Now, if we look at the XOR truth table, so the exclusive OR, so you see the difference. For the first 3 rows, it's basically the same thing as an OR, but the last one is different. So if both input are 1, it returns a 0. It's only that if one of them has a 1, so you get the 1. And the properties, they are different from the OR, but the last one, presenter, Chris, this property here is the one that is very useful in cryptography, because if you do, it's almost like B is your encryption key. So if you do A XOR B, you just encrypted that message. And if you do XOR B, so using the key again, you get your original message back. So XOR is used a lot in cryptographic algorithms. One way hash function. So on one of the Q&A, one of the presenters talk about that. So I will cover basically the same information. So a one way hash function has many names, compression function, contraction function, message digest, fingerprinting, cryptographic checksum, message integrity check, and manipulation detection code, MDC. But they all mean the same thing. It's a one way hash function. One-way hash function is another building blocks that is used in many cryptographic protocols. Like, for example, in digital signature, it's using a one-way hash function. A hash function is a function, mathematical or otherwise, that take a variable length input string, call a pre-image, and it can be a string of character, but it can be a file, it can be an image, it can be a movie, whatever. You want to get that the one-way hash function of and convert it to a fixed length, generally smaller, output string called the hash value. A one-way hash function is one that works only in one direction. It is easy to compute the hash value from the pre-image, but it's hard to generate a pre-image that hash to a particular value. People all have heard about Bitcoin. So this is what they do. They do a hash function of all the a good chunk of the transaction, and to validate that transaction, make sure that nothing has changed, they use as a hash function. A good one-way hash function is also collision-free. In other words, it is hard to generate 2 pre-images that will have the same hash value. if you change a single bit in the pre-image, in the pre-image, on the average, half of the bit in the hash value will change. So can you imagine if you change many bits, a lot of the hash value will be completely different. So basically, you can think of this as a fingerprinting a file. If you want to verify that someone has a particular file that you also have, but you don't want him or her to send you the file, then you can ask them to do the hash value and send you. And if the hash value matches the one that you generated, basically the two files are the same file, similar. For example, you can download the WinMD5. It's a small program that generates hash value. So you type the command and you put the file that you want to generate a hash, and it will return something that looks something like these strings of numbers and letters. And even like that program, they give them their MD5 value to make sure that what the programmer created is really, you downloaded the correct file. Okay, next slide. So we'll look at some example of algorithm and the joke. It's not really secure what they have done. Next. So the perfect encryption scheme. So there's one, it's called the one-time pad. It was invented in 1917 during World War One by Major Joseph Milburn and AT&T Gilbert Burnham. So a one-time pad is nothing more than a large, non-repeating set of truly, and this is really important, that are truly random key letters written on sheet of paper and glued together in a pad. The sender used the key letter in turn on the pad and encrypt exactly one plain text character. The encryption is the addition modulo, so that's why I talked about modulo earlier in the presentation, 26, i.e. the number of letters in the alphabet, so we have 26 letters, of the plain text character and the one-time pad key character. Each letter is used once for only one message. If you start repeating, you're giving information to the crypto, the cryptanalysis will be able to start decoding your message. The sender encrypts the message and then destroy the use page of the pad to make sure that you cannot recover it easily. The receiver has an identical pad and use each key on the pad in turn to decrypt each letter on the ciphertext and then destroy the same pad page. A random key sequence added to a non-random plain text message produces a completely random ciphertext message, and no amount of computing power can change that. The key letter have to be generated randomly and never to be used again, ever. So here's an example. Say that our input was one-time pad, and the key letter is this set of letters. It needs to be the same length as the input. So we have 10 characters here, so the key letter needs to be 10 characters, and this will have been generated at random if you want. And now if I want to generate the output, you go and you look for the first letter. Here is a O in one time. You go at the, you look at, look up the number below. So it's 14. So 14 plus, and the first encryption letter is in the key is T. So T is 19. So 14 plus 19 is 33 mod 26. So basically you need to figure out what is the remainder of that division. In that case, it's easy. It's 7. And from the table below, you go look at 7, and you get the letter H, which is the first letter of the output. And you just repeat that one by one. But as soon as you move one letter in the output, you move one letter in the key letter on the one-time pad if you want, and you keep doing the same kind of math. When it's time, when it's received at the other end, and it's time to decrypt, so the output become the input, and you use the same key. And instead of adding when it's time to decode, you need to subtract And if you get a negative number because of that subtraction, you need to add 26 to bring it back to a positive number. So you do the same thing as we did for the encryption. So H, it's 7 minus T, who is T19. And you get a negative number, minus 12, so you need to add 26, which give you 14, and you do mod 26. Since it's below 26, it's basically 14, so you get the O, basically the first O in one-time path. And you keep going, taking all the letter in sequence like this, and you can decode your message. If you try with the same output, if you try a bunch of random keys, some of them will generate, if I use that the key that starts with a P, O, Y, Y, you will get an output that you can understand that is in English, Shaman X. But if you use a different key, you will get also something that you can read as English word, Green Fluid. But most likely, all of the keys, like if you use that key here, you will get something that do not make sense. And since that every plain text message is equally possible, even with a brute force attack, there is no way for the cryptanalysis to determine which plain text message is the correct one. And the number of possible keys is 2 to the power of the message length. So here we have 10 characters, so there is, I don't know if it's millions, billions, or trillions, so there's a lot of keys to try. So you will get all of these. So among these, some of them, like it will give you like Salmon has Green Fluid and all the other words in English that you can read, but most of them will be garbage. But among the ones that are you can read, you will still not know which one is the right one. It will be random. Next slide. So the idea of a one-time path can be easily extended to binary data. So instead of using letters, we can use a one-time path of bits. And instead of adding the plain text to the one-time path, we're going to use the XOR function. And to decrypt, you XOR the ciphertext with the same one-time path, the same bit sequence that you have done. And everything else remains the same. The security is just as perfect. Sounds all good, but there is a few problems. You need the key bits must be random, and you can never use them again. The length of the key sequence must be equal to the length of the message. So if you're trying to send, I don't know, 1 gigabyte, if you're trying to encrypt a 1 gigabyte file, you will need a 1 gigabyte key. So that's all. And need to be also, the receiver need that too. And you need to be able to destroy the bits already used and never use them again. We'll look at some building blocks that are used in DES, but they are, these building blocks are also used in many other algorithms. So the first one is called a substitution box or S-box. It's a basic component of a symmetry key algorithm, and it performs substitution. So it replaces some bit pattern with something else. Next key. In general, an S-bus takes some numbers of input bits, M, and transform them into some numbers of output bits, N, where N is not necessarily equal to M. Next. And most S-box are implemented as a lookup table. Next. Fixed table are normally used. The data encryption standard, DES, is using that. But in some cipher, the table are generated dynamically from the key. So even all bits are going to be substituted. The substitution of these bits when you send it to that box is going to be based on the key. So here's an example of the DES Xbox round 5, and it's mapping a 6-bit output to a 4-bit output. So let's say that the input is 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. So you go into the table. So the first thing you need to do is use the other bits. So the other bits is 0, 1. So the line in yellow is the line that has the other bits 0 and 1. So that's on that row. And the inner bits, you look for those in the top row and you find 1101. And when these two things intersect, this is what you get for the output. So the output of that S box in DES will be 1001. An example of a substitution is a César cipher. So this one is named based on Julius Caesar, and he was using that encryption in his private correspondence. It's one of the simplest and most widely known encryption technique. It's a type of substitution cipher in which each letter in a plain text is replaced by a letter some fixed number of positions down the alphabet. The Caesar cipher is easily broken in modern practice of essentially no communication security. It's not really safe, if you want. Caesar cipher uses a left rotation of 3 places equivalent to a right shift of 23 letters. And basically the shift parameters can be used as the key if you wanted to be a more generic cipher. And that will be, if you want, the how to encrypt message using a Caesar cipher with a 3. So if in your plain text, if it's a letter A, it will be replaced with X. The big drawback of that is the same letter is always replaced with the same output. It does not change the frequency of the letter. So this is why a good cryptanalyst will be able to decipher the message. The letter E appear very often, so you will be able to figure out that, oh, B is the E, and after that, from there, you will be able to break your encryption. The next one is called a permutation box. So a permutation box is a method of bit shuffling used to permutate or transpose bit across the S box inputs. So there is 3 types of permutation possible. The first one is a straight P box. So the same number of bits are coming out. So we have 5 input bits, 5 output bits will be, and it will, like, the bit one will be sending instead at the output of bit the fourth line, if you want. 2 will be 1, 3 will be 5, 4 will be 3, and 5 will be 2. So the bits are shuffled, if you want. The next one is a compression P box. So some bits are basically dropped, like bit 2 and 4 just basically disappear, and only 1, 3, and 5 survive. And you can do press enter. Okay. Or you can have an expansion box that the 3 bits basically are grown to a much larger number of bits. Now we're going to look at the data encryption standard. So it's using a block of a 64-bit plain text. So that's about 8 characters. What is coming out of that is a 64-bit ciphertext. And the algorithm is controlled with a cipher key of 56 bits. So it starts with an initial permutation. So basically, the input bits, the plain text, are just moved around. Okay, they are. And after that, it goes into round 1, and the key is sent into a roundup key generator that generates a smaller. So that key one key is a subset of the key that was given to the algorithm, and this is sent as an input to round 1. So bits are moved around in round 1, and after that they go into round 2, and this gets its own key, again, based on that input keys, and bits are shuffled more, and keep doing these rounds, and there is 16, press enter, 16 rounds of moving things around based on the 16 different keys, if you want to operate it from the input keys. And when this is all done, there's a final permutation moving more stuff around, and this is what is being output as the encrypted text. There's, I don't know if you recall when I talk about that table that had money and stuff like that. If you have a 56-bit today, it can be broken very easily just because the hardware are so, like what theirs was designed in the 70s. In these days, the hardware was not what it is today. But if you have the proper software, 35 hours, you can try. You can guess what that key is and decipher the message. And also, after that this was published, they discovered it was a number of weak key. So, and it was about 10 of them, that if you use that key, people, a crypto analyst was able to decipher your message. Now we're going to look what a typical round in this look like, just to give you an idea. So we have two inputs. So we have the left and we have the right, and we have that key bit. So the left, the right, it just basically move all the way down and becoming the out bit for the next round. The left goes down and it's going to be XOR with something. So we're going to look at what is going to be that other input for the XOR. So press enter. So the first thing is we saw earlier in the presentation what a expansion permutation box is. So it goes from 32 bit to 48 bits and it moves bits around. Now this is done, an XOR is done with the input key. And when the output of that, there's a substitution box, and I give you an example of that, that is done, that thing, that 48 bit, and reduce it to 32 bits. And after that, there's another permutation that is being done. So these bits are moved again, and various, not random, because it's fixed for each round, they know exactly how they're going to do that permutation, but it changed for each of the rounds. And now you're back, you still have a 32, and that output is XOR with the left side, and this become the right side of the next round. So each round in DES is different, but it look very similar. So sometimes what you will do, instead of all of these things that are done on the right, will be done instead of the left, and they alternate these in each of the rounds. So we're going to look at some, what can we do with cryptology? So the first one is the Hypertext Transfer Protocol Secure, also known as HTTPS. So when you're surfing the net, if you're using HTTP protocol, the data traveled in an encrypted format can be easily intercepted and stolen by anyone listening on the network, on your Wi-Fi network. Every time we connect to a website over HTTPS or using the secure protocol, an encrypted communication channel is established between the client browser, so basically what you're using on your tablet or desktop computer, and the server that is hosting the site. So the first thing you do in the protocol is let's determine which cipher suite is being supported. Some countries do not allow some cipher, so the server and your browser will have a chat to determine, okay, I have these ciphers that I can use. Which one do you have that are the same, and what key then can we use? When they have agreed on a cipher and a key, before they will do the key, they will go into the key exchange. Now they will use an asymmetric algorithm. So they will use their private key and a public key. And most of the time, this will be generated on the fly. And they will securely exchange a pre-master secret key. And the symmetric key is calculated separately by both the client and the server based on the value of the pre-master secret key. So by using the asymmetric algorithm, that key is encrypted. So in theory, people cannot see it. After that, they will say, okay, now let's switch to the symmetric. Let's start using the symmetric key. So they will calculate the key, and they will both the server and the client will send a message that say, okay, let's start using AES 128-bit using that key. And after that, all the remaining communication, which can be large data on your web page, will be encrypted using that key. And it's only valid for that session. And each time you go and open a web page which that starts with HTTPS, that thing is being repeated, and a unique key is generated each time. Digital signature. So in particular implementation, public key algorithms are often too inefficient to sign long documents, because you could basically encrypt it using your private key. Anyone using your public key could decrypt it and get the document back. But like I said earlier in the presentation, these algorithms are really slow. So to save time, digital signature protocol are often implemented using a one-way ASS function. Instead of signing a document, the sender signed the hash of the document. So as you recall, the hash function is one way and it's very fast. So the protocol is the sender produces a one-way hash of the document. The sender encrypts the hash with his private key, thereby signing the document. The sender sends the document and the signed hash to the receiver. The receiver produces a one-way hash function of the document that the sender sent, decrypt the signed hash value and compare them. And you decrypt that using the sender public key, which is available in the PKI. If the signed hash match, the document has not been changed and the signature, not only the document has not been changed and the signature is valid because I've signed it with my, private key. And this protocol satisfies all the characteristics of a signature. In fact, it's probably better than a real signature. It cannot be forged easily. The signature is authentic. The receiver verified the message with the sender public key. He knows that the sender sent it. The signature is unforgeable. Only the sender knows is private key. The signature is not reusable. The signature is a function of document and cannot be transferred to any other document. It's not because I sent you, because in a real life, if you get a letter that I signed with my signature, you can take your scissor, make a copy, and take that signature and use it someplace else. With cryptography, you cannot do that. And the signed document is unalterable, so you know that it was not changed. Because it is, like I said, a hash function. If you change one bit somewhere, the hash will be 50% changed. So if you change a lot of stuff, it will be completely different. And the signature cannot be repudiated, meaning I cannot say I never sent that, because in fact it does not even need that to check the receiver, because as soon as you can just the fact to verify the signature, you know that it was sent by you, because only you have that private key. So we're going to cover a little bit on the quantum computing. I will talk, the first couple of slides talk about what is computer computing and what is the impact on cryptography. So in quantum computing, it's a computation performed using a computing device based on the strange, counterintuitive physical properties of matter at very small scale, known as quantum mechanics. unlike a classical computer based on transistor that encode data in binary digit or bits that can only be a one or a zero, think of on or off, a quantum computer use quantum bits, qubits, where a single bits, qubit, sorry, has two states simultaneously. So basically at the same time, they are both one and zero. Quantum computer should not be confused with quantum cryptography. That's another properties of quantum mechanics, which is a science of exploring quantum mechanic properties to perform cryptographic tasks. A prime example of this is quantum key distribution, which enable a secret cryptographic key to be shared between two remote parties such that any interception will be readily detected. So if you detect that the key has been read by someone else, you just need to send a new one and hopefully you won't intercept that one. So do they exist? Yes, simple, small-scale quantum computers have been built and successfully demonstrated. Currently, these are laboratory instruments that are large, expensive, and complex to use and have very limited capability. So that article was written in 2018, so it's 3 years later now, so maybe they are a bit more capable. But they do prove the underlying physical principle are sound. The challenge is to build one that is big enough in terms of qubit capacity to perform useful tasks better than classical computers. So why quantum computer useful? It is possible to create algorithms that run significantly faster on a quantum computer than on a classical computer due to the unique properties of qubits. These algorithms could be used for a number of different scientific and business applications and will bring many benefits, like look at DNA and that kind of stuff. Some of these algorithms have already been tested and proven on prototype quantum computers, but will not be practically useful or economical until large quantum computers have been built. So how is it relevant to IT security? It is possible to create unique algorithms for quantum computers, and Shor algorithm is one of them, that dramatically reduce the time it takes to break cryptologic algorithms. Symmetric algorithms used for encryption like AES are still thought to be safe if you're using a sufficient key length, like 256 or whatever. Earlier in the presentation, I gave you a table with a key length of 128 bits, and you saw the number of keys was a very long number, 38 digits or something like that. If you use 256 key, you don't double, you square that number of keys, so it takes a whole lot more time. Even though these computer, these algorithms on these computer can be much faster, there's still a lot of keys to try. But the big problem is the asymmetric algorithm like RSA and digital signature will be rendered essentially useless once computer reach a certain scale. They will break nearly every practical application of cryptographic in use today. Many e-commerce, like we use, if the asymmetric algorithm is broken, it means that HTTPS no longer works. People can listen to the communication. Message can be modified because it can regenerate that key. So everything we rely on our daily life will be totally insecure. So that's, as you can imagine, this is a big problem. So what is preventing large quantum computer today? Working at the limit of physics is challenging. While most of the theory is well understood, turning theory into practice at such small scale is a significant scientific and engineering challenge that is taxing many of the world's best scientists. There are numerous fundamental problems yet to be overcome before large-scale quantum computers become feasible. In particular, qubits are highly susceptible to almost undetectable amount of thermal and electromagnetic interference that are difficult to eliminate. So when are they going to become available? I don't think nobody knows for sure. Depending on which article you read, it can be 5 to 10 years, 20 to 30 years, or maybe never. I think it's going to be the 5 to 10 years, but we'll see. And before it's affordable outside of large government agencies, it's probably going to be even longer. And this uncertainty is the biggest worry facing government and business alike, because if that cryptographic protocol do not work anymore, we have a big problem. So what will happen? So many mathematicians are working currently to design better algorithms that are quantum resistant. So they need a whole lot more computation to be able to break them. That cannot be, would not be able to be broken on the quantum computers. However, it takes time to gain confidence that these algorithms don't have other weaknesses. An example of that is DES, thought to be secure in the 70s, but soon after it began to be used, they discovered these weak keys. So the way they solve that problem is to tell people, don't use these keys. But you, most of the time, sometimes these defects is only discovered when people are starting to use the algorithm. A new standard will have to be written and adopted. Many of these being national or industry specific, application will have to be adopted to make use of these new algorithms, which can be a real challenge in some industries, such as banking, where there is a huge amount of legacy infrastructure that cannot be easily upgraded. So in conclusion, in this presentation, I give you an introduction to cryptography, provided a couple of key definitions. We look at some of the basic cryptographic mathematics, basic algorithms and application and impact of quantum computing. Any questions?
Yeah, thanks very much, Stefan. That was fascinating. A lot of information there, some of it at the surface level that even I could understand, some of it which delved into things that I was unsure of, but certainly anybody who is interested in it can read up in some of the reference materials there. We will open, I'm going to do a mute all. And with the ability for everybody to then unmute themselves, if I can find the right one here. So mute all. Okay, so again, Stefan, you'll have to unmute yourself as well. Anybody feel free to unmute yourself at this point to ask any question. We did have one question in the chat that I saw early on. Serge Eric said, if a certificate is expired for a website, what do you recommend that people actually do?
Normally, this should never happen. The system administrator of that website should have that date marked in their calendar. but it does happen. There's some website that it did happen to me. You will not be able to use the web. Like most browser would give you a warning that the certificate is not valid. So you will not be able to do if you're trying to connect with HTTPS. So you may revoke, or you may use instead HTTP, which means that your communication is no longer going to be secure. So my recommendation will be just wait for them to get a new certificate. And most of the time, if websites stop working like that, I'm pretty sure that the pager for the system administrator is probably beeping with a lot of message to go and get that fixed.
So what you're saying then is that it will actually break the encryption. It doesn't continue to operate, but just You know, it should be updated, so it will actually revert in that case to HTTP rather than continuing with an expired certificate?
That's my understanding.
Oh, that's interesting.
Maybe it depends on the setup there, their website too. Maybe they will allow it to continue with the expired certificate. You will get a warning on your web, like your browser will give you a warning. And if I get that warning, I will just wait for them to fix the problem.
Yeah, I have seen expired certificates in the past. Microsoft actually let one of their certificates expire at one point, which is, I hope, really embarrassing. But I never really noted what the effect of that expiry of the certificate was. So that's interesting, you know.
It depends on, I guess, what business rule they want to apply to that. They can decide that one will not use an expired certificate, so we'll stop everything, so nothing will work. Because if you keep, if you're doing it anyway, most of the time, why they more, as there's more information that there is encrypted information and that is available, you're giving more information to a crypto, to a cryptanalyst to be able to figure out what was the key. So most of the, this is why after either a period of time or usage, the normal practice is to change your key, update these keys.
Right.
Okay. One more question.
Yeah.
Who gets to apply for a certificate, who get a certificate? Are they all businesses who get that? Or for me, I have a website that's non-commercial. Do I need a certificate? Who needs a certificate?
Depends. Like when I was working in government, as soon as you were asking to get a PKI account, they were generating that key. So the government of Canada was buying the software and to generate these certificates. If you're buying that service from somebody, most likely is going to be transparent to you. They will just get the certificate that you need. If you're building the website on your own, if you want to provide the, like if you want to use the HTTPS protocol, you will have to get that. And if you go, if you do a search on Google to say, oh, where can I buy a PKI certificate, many service provider for a fee will sell, will allow you to generate one, basically.
One of the things that my understanding of the way that certainly web certificates tend to work is that there are certificate authorities, the CAs, that are baked into the browser that are trusted CAs. So if you get a certificate from any one of them, then your browser will automatically trust the certificate as long as it can verify it with the certificate authority. You can always have a completely untrusted certificate authority. There, Microsoft actually produces code that you can create your own certificates if you want, and then it's up to you to convince somebody to actually trust them. If they decide they want to trust them, it's possible for them to add that as a certificate authority that they will then trust in the future. And some organizations will do that for internal usage because they can easily go to all of their computers on their network and add that certificate authority as a trusted certificate authority, and then everything works fine. It won't work if people are coming in from the outside, but if it's only for internal use, then that works fine. From the perspective of being non-commercial and you don't want to spend money on certificates, there is, I believe it's called Let's Encrypt, is a service that is available that is a trusted security authority, a certificate authority. The main issue with that, any certificates that are they issue, because they'll give a certificate to anybody, what they can be used for is to encrypt the traffic, but they can't be really trusted to say that the origin is a particular entity, because they will give out certificates to anybody who wants one. So it is highly recommended now that you actually, if you're running a website, that you do get a certificate of some sort, because a lot of the browsers now are starting to really argue if they see that you're using HTTP as opposed to HTTPS, and they will come up with all kinds of warnings saying, you know, this is insecure site and things like that. So it is getting to the point now where the default for web browsing is HTTPS, and for that you do need a certificate. But as I say, I'm pretty sure it's called Let's Encrypt. You can get free certificates from them if all you're interested in is ensuring that your traffic is encrypted and you're not worried about people being able to verify the authenticity of the organization.
Yeah, actually, Christian has...
When I was working in the government, when I had to get one of these certificates, I had to go see an IT person, and I had to show up there with my employee ID and another piece of ID to really prove that I was Stéphane Richard. So that certificate was going to be associated with me. So this is how they can make sure that if I encrypt something or sign something using that certificate, it was really signed by Stéphane Richard. When I was, when you were talking about the certification authority, when I was working at Passport Canada, I was a director of the project management bureau over there. And one of the projects that I had was the electronic passport, and we had to set up one of these CA for certification authority, like the top, if you want, of these certification process. And this was not the most. I read the report. It was more lawyers and witness involved in all of this to make sure that the people that were typing the command to generate these keys, the first set of keys, were not trying to do it in a way that it would be able to recover the information later on. So
yeah, it's not trivial for to be a certificate authority, that's for sure.
So Tristan has posted the Let's Encrypt URL in the chat window.
Yeah. Yeah, so if anybody wants a certificate, you can go there and you can get one, no problem. If you go to one of the other ones like Entrust or something like that, certainly you have to do much more to prove who it is you say, because when you go onto a website and you get the lock symbol, and if you click on the actual lock, you'll get, you know, I'm just in Chrome here and I get connection is secure. And if I click on that, it will actually come up and it'll give me information about that particular certificate, who it was issued to, and so forth. So, you know, if it's Let's Encrypt, they can't really attest to who was issued to, because they don't do any checks. But places like Entrust and so forth will do some kind of additional validation, so that if it says that this certificate was issued to the Ottawa PC User Group or something like that, then they have some assurance that, yes, indeed, that is the name of the organization, and, you know, there's some accountability involved. And I'm just, while I'm talking here, if I go to opcug.ca,
as was mentioned earlier, when you have a web host, they will often provide a certificate for you. And I think that's what we've done with Rebel for OPCUG.
Yeah, it has been issued to opcug.ca. So they are using a CA that, you know, is, and we have a certificate that is specific to our organization. And they are relatively assured that, yes, this really is us. But there's nothing beyond opcug.ca, which you already know because that's the URL that you went to. So, you know, I mean, the whole idea of, you know, attestation can be really, really difficult to really be sure that, you know, when you go to Microsoft.com, that you are actually talking to an organization that is Microsoft Incorporated or whatever.
And just kind of sure that Let's Encrypt does require domain verification by the owner.
Oh, okay. That's interesting, because my understanding was, and this goes back a number of years, was that they would basically give it to anybody. But I guess, yeah, they're attesting that you own that particular domain before they will give you a certificate. But what does that mean if somebody owns a domain? You know, it's not a whole lot of information. It doesn't say they're necessarily trustworthy or anything else. But to me, one of the biggest things about certificates is that the traffic will be encrypted.
Yeah, Tom says that Let's Encrypt certificates only lasted 3 months, but they can automatically be renewed by having a file in the website.
Oh, good idea. Yeah. Anyhow, I have been very happy not to have to deal with the nitty-gritty of any of this stuff.
There was a comment earlier, Stefan, from Timothy. He said that he had, in the past tense, I had a PL1 program that used the Julius Caesar method.
there's an old joke, too, about there's a ROT, a rotation cipher, which I guess is the Julius Caesar type of rotation, where you just move it a certain number down letters down the alphabet. And ROT13, rotation of halfway down the alphabet, was considered to be pretty good. And somebody said, well, yeah, but if you want to be twice as secure, you just do a ROT26, where A maps to A, B maps to B, C maps to C.
If I may say something?
Yep.
I was interested by that also because of I don't care about the security as such, but I do care about Google search. And from what I understand is that if you don't have a secure website, now Google will put you down a lot.
Yeah, I remember hearing that as well. So that would be a good reason for sure. Mm-hmm. But even from the end user perspective of just, you know, going to a website and having the browser pop up with, you know, warnings that this site is insecure doesn't look good. And so because you can get a free certificate from Let's Encrypt, pretty simply, you know, there's no reason if you're running a website that if you can't get it through your web hosting service, if you're web hosting yourself, you know, it's worth the effort, I think, to get that that certificate on the web server. And your comment there, Joss, that you'll get marked way down in Google rankings if you don't have HTTPS. That'd be a good reason to make sure that you've got a certificate on your website.
So these the HTTPS protocol does two things. The first thing is make sure by that the certificate that the website has obtained, make sure that, if, for example, if I go to the Royal Bank website, I want to make sure that I'm dealing with the Royal Bank and not somebody else that bought the domain name and it's no longer Royal Bank, but it's still using the same URL, if you want. And at the same time, it's encrypting your communication between your desktop and the server. But once it's on the server, who knows what they do with it, right? they may no longer secure it. So people need to realize that too.
I know that I was looking a little bit at OpenSSL. I'm not too sure that's a good option. And also, I've seen also on Rebel, you can buy a certificate for something like $20, but there is other places that offer certificate, but the price vary quite a lot from $20, I have seen the cheapest, to something like $300. So I'm not too sure if
it's probably the difference between the two is probably the certification authority, how many processors and lawyers they got involved in creating that one. It's all based on trust, right? Because if I don't trust the certification authority that issued that certificate, how can I make sure that I'm dealing with the Royal Bank or something like that, right?
Yeah. In my case, I have my own home web server, and I like to get things free. So I was kind of interested to see what are the options. And as I said, I don't care about the security, just to get the ranking in Google and avoid those error messages that are annoying. But if there is a free option, I would be very much interested. And I did not know about that Let's Encrypt, which I find interesting.
There used to be the idea of extended validation certificates as well, and they would usually show up on the URL bar in the browser in green. And this was, people paid a lot of extra money to get these EV certificates. And but they seem to have gone the way of the dodo bird, that they're not, you know, either companies aren't renewing them, they don't want to pay that money for it, or and some of the browsers have dropped any indication on the URL bar that actually indicates that it's got extended validation. It was kind of neat because right on the address bar, it would actually show the name of the organization, not just the URL to it. And I thought it was really, really good, but it seems that it's over the last couple of years, it's gone away. I wrote a little bit about that in an article that I wrote on encryption in the newsletter going back a couple of years ago. So if you're interested, you could read that, check that article. Just search on for encryption on the OPC UG website. I was wondering, Stefan, if you could answer on when you were talking about brute forcing things, and you were saying how the if you're brute forcing it, you just have to basically look at the output and say, does this make sense or not? Is there nothing in the protocols for encryption and decryption that would tell you that you've decrypted it with the right key? Or are you just blindly looking at the output and saying, is this output make sense? And one of the reasons why I ask is if you give, say, an executable file or something like that, it's not easy to see that, you know, this file is actually a valid file just by looking at the bits. It's all binary data.
Yeah, you're correct. So the encryption algorithm do not really care what the content is.
Yeah. So I was thinking one of the ways of beating the whole idea of being able to decrypt this would be if you encrypt it, and say we'll use two different algorithms for it. So we'll encrypt it using one algorithm, then we'll take the output and we'll encrypt that using a different algorithm. And I can't see any way that somebody trying to brute force it, because none of the, you know, you decrypt it with the second one, you still end up with encrypted text that just looks like nonsense.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't know which of the, you know, several billion, or trillions or hundreds of trillions output was correct.
Like in the World War II, when the Allies were trying to break the Enigma encryption machine that the Nazis were using, One of the end they had is all the message at the end was the last sentence, and the message was always "I Hitler." So with that, they already had a good end if they had the right key in the last sentence or the last word in that message were these words. They knew that they found the key. So these are the kind of stuff a cryptanalysis will look at: repeating keys, messages that are always, like, sometimes when you send like an executable file, the first character is NZ. That's the initial of the guy in Microsoft that created that format. So this is how you know, this is how Windows know it's an executable file. But most of the files, they have a certain format they follow, like a Word file, the format, I don't know it, but the format is known. It's published, like the DocX format. It's published now, so you know what it is. So you can figure out if the output you got is a real Word file or is it something that did not make sense.
Yeah. Just for anybody who's interested, Stefan had mentioned about WinMD5 in his presentation. I just pasted that into the chat window as well. If anybody's interested in being able to hash things, I think it was the last Q&A, we had a discussion about hashing and the ability, several programs that could run hashes, and you could then compare to hash values that, you know, software distributor put on their website or whatever that said, you know, if you download this file, it should hash to the following, as well as some, you could add properties to, or a tab to the properties dialog box on a file, which would do the hashing for you as well. So if anybody's interested in being able to hash files, take a look at the Q&A. Alan, correct me if it's wrong. That was that last week?
We talked about that. It was, yes.
Yeah, okay. So take a look at last week's Q&A, and there's a bunch of information there.
Hi, it's Corrine. Stefan, thanks very much. A couple of questions. I'll go with the first question. I was really interested in knowing what motivated you to go into this field.
It just happened that all the various jobs I had in both in the military and after that in National Defense and Passport Canada, I always run into projects, files that involve these processes, so I have to learn the difference between the two, so I can have an intelligent discussion with my staff.
Okay, that makes I understand that. The other question I have is, what's next for cryptography? Like, what do you see, in your opinion, is the future? And I say this in the context of how our youth really don't care about whether something's encrypted or secure or not. They're more interested in getting access to what they want to get access to. There isn't really that, I don't believe that there's that education part about, you know, fraudulent behavior, attacks, and all of that kind of thing. So what do you think is the future? And, you know, how can young people, you know, be made aware of cryptography?
You need to make them realize. They will realize when they have a big problem that they do. Like, for example, if they send their income tax and the channel is not encrypted, their SIN, a social insurance number, is just being made public, and this is the first number they need to start stealing your identity. And when you have that happen to you, you have a truckload of problems coming your way. So people need to realize that it's very sensitive information. You need to make sure that not only the communication is encrypted between your workstation and the server, but also what are their security protocol on the server itself. Like, for example, last week, Chris, I don't recall which one, was presenting the various income tax software, and some of them are cloud-based. And me personally, even though it would be using the HTTPS, I know the encryption would be encrypted from my machine to that server, but once it's on the server, how is it secure? I don't know. So I'm going to take that chance to have my SIN number and my other financial information on a web server somewhere that can be in China or Russia, right? So for me, it would not be my first choice to use a cloud server to do my income tax just because of that. I much prefer something that I have on my workstation that I know I can keep the information secure. And when I send it to CRA, it's encrypted, and CRA has its own process to store that information securely. So.
Okay, just a correction that your cryptographic hashes was actually done on the 29th of December. And I put the link in the chat window.
Okay.
Just as a counter a little bit to what you said, Stefan, about trusting your information on a remote server, I agree with you as long as you are willing to make sure that your computer is secure.
Yeah.
I think in a lot of cases you'll find that an organization out there might do security better than you do it on your own personal computer. However, counter to that, I guess, is the idea that some place like H&R Block is going to be a much bigger target for people trying to break in and steal financial information than they're going to be looking around on my computer for financial information. So, you know, it's a little bit back and forth, but yeah, well taken, that idea that you really should think about it and make a decision rather than just defaulting to, oh, well, I'll just do this.
I don't know if you recall, this is before my time at Passport Canada. They had an application that was called Online Passport or something like that. And it was a major security breach, because when in the URL, it was using HTTPS. Now, that was not the issue. But if you were removing the last character in the URL and going back to the first slash, you were getting access to all the applications that were submitted that day or that month. So even though it was encrypted from your computer to their computer, but it's over there. Somebody that knew that trick. So.
Yeah. And we all hear about the number of websites that are getting breached and tons of personal information getting leaked out. So
there you go.
It definitely happens.
Yeah.
So, okay. We're run just a little bit over time now. Now, I don't think we need to necessarily cut off, but if there are any final questions or comments, by all means, people can chime in.
I have one.
Yep.
I'm just curious, what sort of overhead would you expect on a HTTPS channel from the encryption?
My experience, I think with the computer today are so powerful that I think the overhead is almost negligible. Like, it's very little compared to what you need to do. Like, honestly, if you load a page with HTTP versus HTTPS. In the presentation, I explained the protocol, and these, probably all that protocol is probably finished in milliseconds or something like that. So you don't really see it. So I think, like many years ago, I worked on a security project that they were talking about encrypting everything on our drive. And in these days, this was like 20 years ago, the computer were not that powerful. So I think the performance impact in these days would have been great. But today, on Windows, you can get BitLocker, and it will encrypt your hard drive, and it's transparent. And I have yet to see a performance impact, I guess. So.
Thank you. Thanks. Very, 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 very well done presentation.
Thank you.
Tristan just commented on his servers at work doing AES 512 encryption adds 1% to the CPU load. So basically you should not ever be able to notice any difference on it.
We're 20 years ago, like this is why, like you see in the table I showed during the presentation was the number of the key length, the number of bits. In these days they knew that longer key was better. But they have to make a trade-off between the performance and impact. So when they designed this in the 70s, computers were still in their FNC. So 56, like I don't think they had 8-bit computer in these days, right? So 56-bit was a big problem to create a computer would be able to do all of these functions. But look at how fast, like we went from 8-bit to 16-bit to 32-bit. Now we have 64-bit machine. So the thing is almost growing exponentially.
Okay, just as a final, I pasted in again Stefan's presentation deck, the URL that it's at on our website. It'll also be posted to the past presentations section of our website, so you can pick it up there if you wanted to review the material and so forth. So I would like to thank again, Stefan. That was a fascinating presentation. A lot of really, really good information. And on behalf of all of the membership, I would like to extend my thanks to you. And we're getting lots of thanks coming into the chat window as well.
Great.
So hopefully, folks, we'll see you at Q&A on Wednesday evenings. And with that, we'll call it an end for tonight. So thanks very much for attending.
And close the recording, please.
Yes, we'll do.